From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is fellow VOA broadcaster Peter Cloete. He is host of Nightline Africa and One-on-One with Peter Cloete. Our guest on this edition of the program is J. Peter Pham, Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based here in Washington. Our topic, African hotspots, from Nigeria to the Gambia to the Democratic Republic of Congo and many places in between, we analyze current conditions in critical African countries with J. Peter Pham, a foremost African expert who is no stranger at these VOA microphones. Just last Tuesday, a Nigerian Air Force fighter jet on a mission against Boko Haram extremists mistakenly bombed a camp for displaced people, killing more than 100 civilians and many humanitarian aid workers. This bombing comes as the military claims more and more territory in Borno State, Boko Haram's stronghold. Nigerian officials expressed deep sadness and regret, calling the incident an accidental bombing. In neighboring Gambia, longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh's decision not to step down even after losing to challenger Adama Barrow in the December 2016 election has created political turmoil. We'll also speak with J. Peter Pham about the agreement for political transition in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the U.S. move to lift a 20-year-old trade embargo against Sudan, unfreeze assets, and remove financial sanctions in response to Khartoum's cooperation in fighting the so-called Islamic State and other terror groups. Peter is a valued Africa analyst on my Encounter program, and we are delighted to welcome him back this week as our sole guest on Press Conference USA. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Always a pleasure to be with you.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Peter Cloete.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, J. Peter Pham, let's first start with Nigeria and this unfortunate tragedy that occurred last week. Let's look at it by way of evaluating the war on Boko Haram and the long-term strategy to combat it. Just a year ago, Nigeria was declaring that Boko Haram was all but defeated. What does this unfortunate tragedy say about the claim regarding this strategy and the state of Boko Haram?
Well, Carol, first and foremost, I think, as you said, it's a tragedy, and certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to the victims, their families, and indeed the people of Nigeria as a whole. To be fair, the fight against Boko Haram has gone rather well, and significant progress has been accomplished over the course of the last 2 years, certainly the last 18 months since President Muhammadu Buhari took office in Nigeria. I was out there just 2 months ago on the front lines, literally 5 kilometers away from Boko Haram positions, visiting military units with a small study group. So I saw firsthand what was going on. So there's been progress made. But as the fact that military operations are still ongoing, the progress made does not mean that the war is finished or the insurgency has been put down. It's still ongoing. And in that fight, not only do tragedies occur, but this underscores several things to me. First, the desperate need for better training and equipment. Secondly, the need for better intelligence, including intelligence sharing. Thirdly, the need, and I'm not trying to blame anyone, but I think it's very important, the better coordination between military, non-governmental organizations, humanitarian groups, civilian officials, because clearly people knew where this camp was. The International Committee for the Red Cross was there. Several of its volunteers and a staff member regrettably lost their lives. Somehow, this information did not filter to the right places in the operations side of the Nigerian Air Force, and we have this tragedy. So a communications, I'm not trying to blame anyone, but I think it's something that has to be underscored.
Unfortunate tragedy underscores also that military means are simply not enough. What do you know about any other approaches that are being undertaken, either to improve economic conditions, part of which gave rise to Boko Haram and the fuel of Boko Haram?
On the immediate level, it's been several years since many of these areas have been cultivated because of the threat of Boko Haram. There's massive food insecurity. We're talking about millions of people who are food insecure right now in this region that need help urgently. Appeals have been made by the United Nations, et cetera, and they need to be responded to. Secondly, security and development go hand in hand. You know, one of the places we visited when we were out there 2 months ago was a town called Polka. It's a critical crossroads between the Sambisa forest, where Boko Haram forces were holed up, and Cameroon. And it was held by a military unit, the 121 Battalion, which, in addition to protecting the civilians, mainly women, older people, and children there, they were also running the schools, feeding the people, because until very recently, until just weeks before we visited, there were no non-governmental groups active there. So the military was having to provide these things, which is a good thing they did, but the fact that humanitarian groups weren't there on the scene. So that's part of the issue, is you have to balance the safety and the risk, and that's been part of the challenge.
Peter,
Obinna Ezekwesili, the lady who leads the Bring Back Our Campaigns team, was invited by Lai Mohammed, the information minister, and she was made to tour the Sambisa forest after supposedly the Nigerian army cleared it. However, what they are not saying is some of these soldiers came out and said they don't have equipment. They don't even have water to fight Boko Haram. Yet some of them are being court-martialed or prosecuted for that matter. How do you think the Nigerian government can resolve some of these concerns expressed by these military guys who are on the front lines fighting Boko Haram?
Well, I think the situation has improved tremendously in the last 18 months or so, but it is certainly far from perfect. No one is saying that. And even within the same branch of the military, I think they're uneven. Their units, they're extraordinary. They're first rate. And there are others that, from what we saw, probably could use a little extra training, to say nothing of equipment and other things. So there's unevenness there. And then between the branches, I think in particular, I would single out the Nigerian army has improved tremendously, I think, under the new leadership installed by President Buhari. The Air Force, one could say, even before this recent tragedy, a little less.
Let me ask you about the Gambia. Looking at the stance of the African Union, particularly ECOWAS, ECOWAS being one of the most effective regional blocs on the continent, looking at their stance, do you side with them? Because they were harsh and saying, well, elections have happened, you have lost, you initially congratulated Adama Barrow, we will back the new president-elect, whether you like it or not. You like their stance?
It's one, a sense that ECOWAS has signaled for years it would take. There is an agreement within ECOWAS, as part of ECOWAS, the acknowledgement that elections stand, and if you lose elections, you leave. And as longtime leader Yahya Jammeh himself acknowledged immediately after Adama Barrow won the election, quite clearly, he admitted he lost. Now, I think where a mistake was made, a tactical mistake, perhaps a strategic one, by some members of the winning opposition, was then they began, before they assumed power, to talk about justice and trials. That scared Mr. Jammeh and his people, and then they rethought the wisdom of giving up power. That meant they would face consequences. I'm not arguing for impunity, but perhaps that conversation should have been saved for a later moment when they were securely in office. But we have a crisis, and now the credibility of the African Union and the credibility of the sub-regional organization are in play. Now, how we go about doing this, hopefully in a peaceful manner, but if necessary, I think the will of the Gambian people has to be respected.
Peter, speaking of long-standing rulers who refuse to step down, let's now turn to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where last year, at the stroke of midnight, one could almost say, in December 31st, the Catholic bishops brokered a deal by which President Joseph Kabila, who was in office since 2001 and has basically overstayed his term and was widely believed to have looted millions, that he would step down by the end of this year, 2017, and the opposition would play a meaningful role in a transitional government. The problem is Mr. Kabila has not actually signed off on the deal. So why the euphoria, and how do you see this playing out?
I think there is euphoria on the part of those who want to avoid conflict. But the deal itself really wasn't so much a deal as statement of principles with a lot of issues kicked down the road, including how to implement it, who would be doing the implementing. So it got a deal in before the new year, but the implementation the last few weeks has been rather slow. The current prime minister, Sami Badibanga, has refused to vacate his position, although the accord said very clearly that the opposition would present someone to be prime minister. And that was the opposition that did not take part in the so-called unity government of 18 October 2016. So it was very clear that Mr. Badibanga is not qualified, but he refuses to step down. President Kabila and the presidential majority in the National Assembly have not done anything to push him out. So that's a major stumbling block. That unless that's resolved, clearly the rest of the deal is in jeopardy. And I think what one begins to wonder is whether the deal was signed in good faith or was it signed to head off the possibility that the European Union and the United States would move quickly if a deal were not signed to sanctions affecting the president, his family, and their closest collaborators.
Do you think there should be a guarantee or pressure put on the Kabila government in Kinshasa to respect this agreement that was enacted recently? Because if that is not done, we might see some chaos or some instability, which effectively might affect the entire region as it is.
I've had a number of conversations in recent days with religious leaders, including members of the Bishops' Conference, with civil society, as well as with opposition political figures. And all are sort of, if the deal is not implemented soon. Now, they give me different timetables of when they think the breaking point is going to be, but we're not talking a matter of months. We're talking a matter of weeks at most. If the deal isn't implemented, then they're going to take this as a sign of bad faith, and I think we will see a return to demonstrations, and at that point, then anyone's guess how it plays out.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing crises and long-term prospects for political transitions in Africa. Joining me on the program is VOA's Peter Cloete, host of Nightline Africa and One-on-One with Peter Cloete. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a big shout out to Umaro Labarandabo from Kano in the Democratic Republic of Congo. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, J. Peter Pham. And let's turn now to the summit that recently took place, Africa-French summit in Bamako, Mali. It was attended by over 30 African heads of state. France, of course, went into the north part of Mali to fight off terrorists. 4,000 troops still remain in the country. Talk about the results from this summit.
The 27th Africa-France summit, in many ways, was, as one commentator put it, the swan song of François Hollande. He's leaving office as literally the most unpopular head of state the French Fifth Republic has ever had. He gave up running for a second term because he would have been killed in the primaries of his own party, much less in the general election. But one of the few bright spots in his legacy has actually been his engagement, at least on the security front in Africa. The decision, unlikely as it seemed at the time in 2013, to intervene in Mali, probably helped save the country from utter collapse and takeover by Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb and its assorted allies. He was very warmly received then, and he was certainly very warmly received this time by Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, and the assembled African leaders. He also had the intervention later that year, 2013, as well in the Central African Republic to help stave off a turn for even worse in what had become an increasing sectarian violence in that country, and again, a timely intervention. So he has a bit of a history, and this was a victory lap of sorts, a warm welcome for an otherwise embattled lame duck. On the other side of this, a lot of promises made by this president, and many of them kept in terms of foreign assistance to Africa, upping up that game. And in fact, more promises were made during the Bamako summit. Probably the only part of his legacy that probably is tarnished a bit is the question of France joining in that other Africa, that Africa that is increasingly economically buoyant, growing. French business and trade with Africa has actually declined. While Africa is growing, French share of that business and trade has actually declined significantly during Hollande's tenure, and the largest French business association actually lamented the fact that Bamako had been chosen for the summit, saying it was a political decision as opposed to a business decision where they would have preferred, and the head of that association actually suggested Dakar, Senegal, or Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire as more in line with where Africa is, at least French-speaking Africa, in dynamic economies.
Interesting. Are others gaining where France is losing, other countries in terms of business?
Well, certainly we've seen over the last years the growth not only of China and its volume of trade with Africa, but increasingly other countries, India, Turkey, and others, as well as the United States maintaining its position and the UK as well. So France has been declining, and that's probably one of the things that will mark also the Hollande years.
Quickly, before I turn to my colleague, Peter, a follow-up on Mali, because we also witnessed last week a suicide bomber inside a camp that was housing hundreds of former rebels and pro-government fighters. Does this deal a blow to these very counterterrorism efforts that France has helped to foster? How do you see this, a setback?
Yeah. Well, I think the French military intervention in Mali, Operation Serval, staved off a extremist takeover of the country. But what it didn't do, and perhaps it was expecting much for it to do, is entirely root out the causes and the ongoing insurgency, which is why MINUSMA, the UN peacekeeping mission that has taken responsibility for Mali, is actually, for 2016, it was the deadliest blue-helmeted mission anywhere in the world. Some three dozen soldiers, personnel from different countries killed and dozens more wounded. Highest casualty rate of any UN peacekeeping mission. So there's clearly a lot to be done. And it's not just in Mali. This is a transnational problem across the Sahel in Mauritania, Niger, and as we saw in 2016, regrettably spreading into also Burkina Faso and Côte d'Ivoire.
Why do you think the administration in Bamako is having a hard time in trying to bring semblance of security? Because they are helped by the African Union, because it has a mission there, and then the UN, and other countries are supporting as well. I don't know why it's so difficult for them.
Well, I think one is the sheer size of Mali, as you know, Peter. It's a very large country. This is a country that is several times the size of France, a large area. And then there's the population. A majority, 80% of the population, lives in the southern one-third of the country. And there, if you go to Bamako, I was there last summer, you see a lot of progress. You see things being built, things coming back, and a lot of dynamism going there. But in the north, you don't see that. Part of it is insecurity. Part of it is this tension. If you're a democratic government, and Mali has a traditional history, the blip of the coup being literally a blip of a long history of constitutional rule, you are going to pursue the votes where they're at. And the majority of the votes are in the south. And there you see economic activity. So the government's clearly catering to the majority of the population. That's how democracies work. But the problem is then that leaves a part of the country that is neglected or at least not as catered to. And that's a problem. But it's a tension between the political calculus of democracy and the requirements of statesmanship. And that's always in tension, and not just in African countries.
Before I go back to Carol, the last time I spoke with the ambassador here in Washington, he was so buoyant about the government plan to have agricultural development in the north, because they said they have some arable lands there that they can develop. Why isn't this plan not working? Because the Tuaregs, after having an agreement with them, said, okay, we'll go into farming. It's a booming business. We can make a lot of money instead of, you know, just being mercenaries around the region. Why hasn't this been able to work?
I would attribute largely to insecurity. Remember, it's not the local people who necessarily want violence or want insecurity. It's also outside actors, some of them exploiting opportunities they find in the local community, grievances, et cetera, who want to keep this stirred up. And so as long as they can manage to keep it stirred up, no rational businessman is going to invest. When even armed soldiers are dying, you're not going to invest. It's not going to happen. And I think that's the problem, is this vicious cycle. Insecurity leads to lack of investment, leads to lack of economic opportunity, leads to more insecurity. And it's a vicious cycle that hopefully the country can escape.
Peter, I'd like to turn now to Sudan, the U.S. policy shift, by way of talking about U.S.-Africa relations. The Obama administration, before leaving office, moved to lift this 20-year-old trade embargo against Sudan, unfreeze assets, and remove financial sanctions in response to Khartoum's cooperation in fighting the so-called Islamic State. What else, in your view, triggered this reversal because it's still quite a brutal regime, and it's still on the state sponsors of terrorism list.
Well, we can discuss the state sponsor of terrorism list. That's an entirely separate discussion that one can have, and whether Sudan should be on that list. And I think that's something we can get into great detail there. However, the lifting of sanctions on Sudan, let me make 2 points, and I don't certainly do not speak for the Obama administration. One is that they did not lift not only the state sponsor of terrorism sanctions, but sanctions connected to individuals and institutions involved in human rights abuses or allegations of the Darfur sanctions. What were lifted were sanctions that have largely affected not the government, but ordinary Sudanese, and had been in place for some, in some cases, 20 years, and had not changed the regime. But in fact, what it had done was given the regime a crutch in which to stand on. Interestingly, over the last week, one of the most popular memes making its way around the social media in Sudan was one which showed a character holding a suit up with a hanger, a suit jacket, and the Arabic caption said, now that they've taken away the sanctions and the hanger was labeled sanctions, how's he going to hold up that old suit? And the point being, I think it was very telling that it was popular, was being people were passing it from one person to the other, was that the government had used sanctions as the blame all. Mismanagement, it's the U.S. sanctions. We lack medical supplies, it's the U.S. sanctions.
it sounds like the U.S. embargo against Cuba.
And for many of the same, lifting that was not a reward for a regime that no one is trying to defend, but I think it was trying to make the sanctions smarter, more applied. And the new administration is going to review it in 6 months, and then there's a further review at the one-year mark about the progress. So it's not only counterterrorism cooperation, it's also ineffectiveness of the sanctions regimes. And I think the third thing was that the sanctions regime also had a disparate impact as it currently stood on actually vulnerable populations.
What about this ongoing terrible tragedy in South Sudan, the civil war? We've talked at these microphones before, Peter. Why this can't be resolved? Why is this continued to fester?
Yes, there's responsibility to go all around, but it comes down to an utter failure of leadership on the part of the leaders of that country. The country came into being with all the goodwill in the world, the support of the African Union, the support of the United Nations, the international community, a lot of goodwill. And it was squandered by officials in the government who, by their own tabulation, stole at least $4 billion from the people of that country, from warring leaders who put their own personal ambitions ahead of the country. It's a complete failure. And it's a complete sense of impunity. When even the African Union, which has not necessarily always had the most noble record of holding leaders to account, documents in excruciating detail the abuses carried out during the civil war, especially by the government side, and yet nothing happens. When that government obstructs the deployment of a protection force mandated by the United Nations, and still more than 6 months later has yet to be deployed, that 4,000, which many of us would argue is not a sufficient force to do that job, and there are no consequences. I think they've learned a lesson, but unfortunately, it's the wrong lesson. And perhaps it's something that in a new administration, we may see something different.
The UK and Norway are proposing fresh talks in Doha to jumpstart the peace process again. And this time, they're trying to bring Riek Machar back into the equation to implement the agreement they recently signed. Do you think this is the best way forward? Because most people have said the problem has to do with ethnicity, with two major ethnic groups fighting for power. Salva Kiir on the Dinka side, and then you have Riek Machar on the Nuer side.
Well, you've got those areas, but you've got other ethnic groups as well, the Equatorians, the Shuluk, and others who also seek representation at the table. So we have to move beyond the ethnic categories. Yes, they play a factor. No one's denying that. But we also have to move beyond the personalities and look at institutions. The fact is, this is a country with no institutions. Given the lack of institutions, no wonder people fall back upon ethnicity, upon personal leaders, etc. So we have to look for a way to build institutions. It may be a case of devolved institutions, but that's something that will take time. It will take a lot of energy. In the meantime, people are suffering. Millions of people are displaced. face food insecurity. And so we've got a real problem to be dealt with. And meanwhile, we have these failed leaders and this so-called government that hangs its invokes sovereignty. Well, sovereignty comes with responsibility. And until these people accept that notion, I'm afraid we're condemned to a vicious cycle of violence and hatred and more violence.
What about the issue of corruption? Because you have Salva Kiir's son owning about 25% share in a government organization, petroleum company. And the recent reports show that even Salva Kiir has benefited from this violent or conflict. How is this going to be resolved? I mean, when will the African Union or perhaps the international community put pressure on these guys to resolve this once and for all? Because they are benefiting from it.
Well, the beautiful thing, Peter, about modern communications and the internet and social media is that these people actually put out this evidence in public against themselves.
Right.
Once upon a time, people who stole money hid it. Now they flaunt it on Facebook and Twitter and other social media. And excellent work is being done by a number of organizations, the Enough Project and others, to bring this to light, because that adds leverage to negotiations. Reminding these people that they've been seen, they've themselves opposed for these pictures, there is going to be a reckoning. And if they refuse to come to terms to help bring peace and some measure of succor to their people, then these things that they themselves have put out there that they have, I think, are legitimate targets for sequester and possibly seizure. And those who help them launder their money, we don't need new laws. We've got the Bribery Act in the United Kingdom, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the United States, and other ways of going after them.
Peter, as we close, after the election of Donald Trump last year in November, we talked with you about perspective U.S.-Africa policy under a Trump administration. We didn't know much then, and I'm not sure if we know much more now that he's in office. But how would you advise, what would you suggest the United States do differently, perhaps, than the previous Obama and George W. Bush administrations, both of which there was quite a bit of continuity, whether it was the PEPFAR on AIDS, promoting business ties, but perhaps not quite enough counterterrorism? What would you suggest or recommend?
I think there are several pillars to U.S. policy in Africa on which there's continuity and which perhaps with a few tweaks could be made more rigorous. Certainly countering violent extremism, countering terrorism, protecting American citizens' interests and those of our friends and allies is paramount. And I would expect that having campaigned on a very strongly on that issue, that President Trump in his administration will certainly emphasize that, helping our partners in Africa combat the violence, root out the violence and extremism in their midst. Secondly, business. Africa is not a basket case. Africa is a vibrant business and private sector that we should be partnering with. There are African businesses whose scale is far beyond our total aid budget for the continent. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with aid, but let's talk about business and building, not just having teach-ins about it, but really making deals that benefit both sides. The American people are extraordinarily generous, especially when faced with real calamity, real catastrophe, real need, insofar as humanitarian aid, very well. We probably need to do some revisiting on the development side and looking for real metrics to whether programs are truly effective, and then pointing the resources to the programs that are and perhaps removing them from the programs that aren't. And finally, partnering as equals, going both sides. Our major trade platform for Africa, with the exception of Morocco, which is a free trade agreement that has benefited, has created hundreds of thousands of jobs in Morocco, and thousands of jobs in the United States. With that exception, the other 53 states in Africa do not have such a relationship with the U.S. Sub-Saharan African countries, some 38 of them, have a relationship through AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, but that's a one-way concession, and charity is not sustainable ever. It's been extended by Congress with broad bipartisan support. It's going to stay there. It also has a sunset provision in less than a decade. And we need to look at the next thing, the next step for a goal, rather than simply renewing it as such.
And if I may add, I suspect many of our African friends would welcome greater U.S. investment in business to counter the Chinese. That might even appeal to Mr. Trump.
And I think there are deals to be had in Africa, and that I think the key is driving some of those home.
J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and the Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Peter, thank you once again for your terrific insights. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Carol. Pleasure to be with you and Peter.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. Joining me on the program was VOA's Peter Clote. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.